Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 4th of September, these are our main stories. A long-awaited report into one of Britain's worst ever residential fires has blamed decades of failure and dishonesty. There have been widespread Russian missile and drone strikes on Ukraine.
I was woken up by the explosions. Each month, each day, Russia is shelling Ukraine, sending ballistic missiles. It's part of the nightmare we are living in.
The Pope is in Indonesia calling for interfaith unity, and a mayor in the Philippines is accused of spying for China. Also in this podcast, we take a trip to Eastern Europe.
The Albanian country has been made famous through millions of articles in the world for its wilderness and its untouched beauty.
But with a huge drive for tourism growth, how long will it stay that way? We start this podcast with the results of a long-awaited report into one of Britain's worst ever residential fires that killed 72 people back in 2017. The team conducting the inquiry was firm in blaming dishonest companies and indifferent authorities for the disaster. The chair of it, Martin Moore-Bick, listed those behind the failings, including successive governments, building companies, the local council and the London Fire Brigade.
The simple truth is that the deaths that occurred were all avoidable, and those who lived in the tower were badly failed over a number of years and in a number of different ways by those who were responsible for ensuring the safety of the building and its occupants. Not all of them bear the same degree of responsibility for the eventual disaster, but as our reports show, all contributed to it in one way or another, in most cases through incompetence, but in some cases through dishonesty and greed.
Shortly afterwards, Natasha Elcock from Grenfell United, which represents the families of those who died in the fire, gave her reaction to the report.
This country has been failed by governments of all political persuasions. Our expectation is your government will break old habits and implement all the recommendations made by Sir Martin Moore-Bick's report, because the time to address this is already 3 decades too late. For the report to be worth anything, it must bring systematic change. To prevent another tragedy like Grenfell, your government needs to create something that doesn't exist. You must become a government with the power and ability to separate itself from the construction industry and corporate lobbying.
Our London correspondent Rob Watson told me more about the findings and how he reported on the fire at the time.
I should say that I was there that morning of the fire reporting on it for the BBC World Service, and in 40-odd years of reporting in the UK on and off for the BBC, it was one of the grimmest things I've ever reported on, and the shock in the community was extraordinary, just to put this in some kind of context. Now, to answer your question, the inquiry has made 58 recommendations, but I'll just pick out, I guess, the sort of first two and the most striking. One is that there should be, from now on, a single construction regulator to make sure that there are standards throughout the country, and that there should be just one government minister to oversee the whole thing, and that the guidance to the construction industry about fire safety should be revised because it's inadequate. I think those are the two main ones that stand out.
And Rob, what happens now in terms of legal action?
So in terms of legal action, it will be up to the Central Prosecution Service in this country to decide, now that the inquiry is out of the way, now that they've heard a lot of evidence, is there enough? Can they build a case, criminal cases, against some of the individuals and companies named? And I don't think that's going to happen tomorrow, Nick, or next week, or in the coming months, but we probably would hear something in the next year or so.
And Rob, in terms of this is being seen to a certain extent, or the Grenfell Wars anyway, in terms of the haves and have-nots. Grenfell, a lot of low-income families in that tower block. The perception was that this was that people turned a blind eye to what was going on in Grenfell because of the types of people there. Is that valid in any way?
That is what the inquiry found, and actually that's what politicians have been saying in the last hour or so since the report came out, that that really was an element, that an awful lot of the people, the majority of people who lost their lives and who lived in Grenfell were people of colour, and that they had been ignored, perhaps partially because of that. In other words, there was a racial factor. I mean, the other aspect that's come out is that essentially this was sort of part of a wider malaise of deregulation and of governments and the construction industry always going for the bottom line. In other words, their main eye was not on the safety of people, but essentially on trying to save money. So a sobering moment for the state.
Rob Watson. To Ukraine now, where Russia's latest assault on the country has seen a major attack on the western city of Lviv. At least 7 people were killed there. It comes after Tuesday's missile strike on the city of Poltava, which left more than 50 dead. It's led Ukraine's president to call once again on the country's allies to provide more air defence systems. The Ukrainian Member of Parliament, Oleksandr Mereshko, spoke to the BBC about the latest strikes.
So far, we know that Kyiv was bombarded. I was woken up by the explosions. Lviv was bombarded, you know, but it happens on a daily basis. Well, each month, each day, Russia is shelling Ukraine, sending ballistic missiles. And we're kind of got used to this. It's part of nightmare we're living in.
The whole country, meanwhile, has been placed under air alert. Nick Beek is in Poltava.
Worth reminding ourselves that Lviv is right in the west of the country. It's only about 40 miles or so from the Polish border, so right on the border of the European Union, crucially right on the edge of the NATO alliance where that begins. But clearly, once again, that has not deterred Russia. What we're hearing from Lviv is that at least 7 people have been killed, including 3 children. And we've been looking at some video that's emerged, and it shows the moment of impact, a huge explosion, and then a very large amount of debris raining down on what is clearly a residential area. So I think Lviv, of all the places targeted once again, the worst affected, although overnight all of Ukraine was under an air raid alert.
Nick, you're in Poltava, the scene of a place where 50 people were killed yesterday in a strike on a big building there. What's the latest where you are?
Yeah, I'm just standing outside it now. It's a military academy, and just around us there are lots of soldiers, as you'd expect, but also tents have been set up. Volunteers have arrived here with food, drink, coffee, and they've been giving refreshments to the emergency services, the police, the fire service, who have been working through the night. Now, this has not been a rescue operation. This has been a recovery operation. We heard last night that at least 18 people were unaccounted for, trapped under the rubble. And just looking at what they're doing now, this is really a case of moving all that has been damaged from this place, because this was a huge double ballistic missile strike. We spoke to one cadet who'd enrolled only 2 weeks ago, who said that the two strikes came in very quick succession and people simply didn't have any time to get to safety. President Zelensky says there needs to be a big investigation into what happened here.
And Nick, all this comes when there's a bit of political upheaval going on in Ukraine at the moment. The foreign minister's just been removed from office. Other people are expected to change in a reshuffle. What's going on?
Yes, we have seen over the past 2.5 years some refreshing of both the military and also the political setup here. President Zelensky has said he's been keen to do that. We haven't got all the details yet, but it does seem that this is quite a significant reshuffle that President Zelensky is doing. Apparently his aim is that he wants to get Ukraine in a better position for the autumn and all the challenges that will bring. I'm thinking about the continued Russian strikes on the energy infrastructure. We don't quite know the details, but certainly we've seen a resignation letter from Foreign Minister Kuleba, who's been a really pivotal figure, someone who's toured around European world capitals over the past 2.5 years and trying to ask for more help.
Nick Beek. A mayor from the Philippines, who's been accused of being a Chinese spy and of involvement in human trafficking, has been arrested in Indonesia. Alice Guo, who was a political novice when she was elected 2 years ago as mayor of a small town north of Manila, is wanted in the Philippines on a number of charges related to offshore gambling hubs operating in her municipality. Questions have been raised in the Philippines Senate about her true identity, with some suggesting she may have been working for the Chinese government. Here's our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head.
The saga of 37-year-old Alice Guo has gripped the Philippines for much of this year. After a police raid on a huge offshore gambling compound in the town where she was mayor revealed evidence of human trafficking and online scam operations. She managed to leave the country in July, but has now been arrested near the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, and is awaiting deportation. Alice Guo was accused of being a part owner of the gambling operation. A Senate inquiry then raised questions about her true nationality after her birth certificate was found to have been registered only when she was 17. No one seems to have known anything about her before she ran for mayor in the small town of Bamban 2 years ago. One senator has suggested that she may be a Chinese spy. Alice Guo says she was brought up by her Chinese father on a pig farm, that she did not know her mother, and that she was schooled at home. The offshore gambling business grew rapidly after it was legalized under the previous Duterte administration, attracting large numbers of Chinese investors. However, the business has been tarnished by links to online scam centers and human trafficking, and was banned by President Marcos in June. The questions raised about Alice Guo's origins have coincided with deteriorating relations between the Philippines and China over disputed islands in the South China Sea.
Jonathan Head. Belarus has released 30 more prisoners who had taken part in anti-government protests. An official statement described this as a humanitarian gesture, saying that the 23 men and 7 women were mostly parents of young children. Human rights activists say there are about 1,400 people in prison in Belarus for voicing dissent against Alexander Lukashenko, who has run the country since 1994. Here's our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
It's 4 years since Belarus was rocked by demonstrations against its presidential election, which saw Alexander Lukashenko return to power for a 6th time. Governments around the world criticized the result as fraudulent, and protesters took to the streets. More than 1,000 were arrested. Now, 30 of those people have apparently been released. But human rights groups say a total of more than 1,400 remain in Belarusian prisons simply for criticizing the government. They've also warned that prisoners are sometimes rearrested soon after being freed.
Paul Moss. From Barcelona to Athens, tourism has become a controversial issue across many southern European destinations, particularly this summer. However, in Albania, holidaymakers are welcomed. According to the UN, it is number one in Europe for tourism growth and 4th in the world. Our reporter Daniel Rosny has been to Albania to find out more.
As you can hear, the crystal clear water is crashing into a beach in Vlorë, the country's 3rd largest city. Around 3 million people live here in Albania, but the government wants 14 million tourists to visit by the end of 2024, like this woman.
Well, why did you come here?
Why? Because it's cheap for us, and I am a mother alone with 3 children. So it's the best option to go to the beach on vacation and have fun.
Last year, the travel and tourism industry made up around 25% of Albania's GDP. That's according to the World Travel and Tourism Council. It's partly thanks to airlines like Wizz Air investing in routes to the Albanian capital, Tirana, 4 years ago. Tamara Nikifrova is from Wizz Air.
We have seen 13-fold growth in Albania in 2023 compared to when we started. Basically, it's 50% growth year on year in the past couple of years.
Other global brands like the hotel chains Marriott, Hilton and Intercontinental have also expanded here. The Albanian government wants to attract more big investors and is offering to lease state-owned land for just over $1 to developers if they create jobs. The former US President Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is hoping to build a $1 billion luxury resort in the city of Vlor.
So Kushner wants to build there?
So my name is Joni Varpsi and I work at Pipinea, BirdLife Albania. The Albanian country has been made famous through millions of articles in the world for its wilderness and its untouched beauty, and that's why millions of people came here last year.
He's concerned about the environmental impact of the resort on protected areas like this one in the nearby Nata Lagoon, home to thousands of flamingos. Kushner's plans haven't been formally approved yet, but he's posted them on his Instagram account. We asked for an interview with Kushner's firm Affinity Partners, but didn't get a response. Others, though, welcome the new development. According to the World Travel and Tourism Council, one in five people in Albania now have jobs supported by tourism. The mayor of Vlor, Ermal Dreda, wants that to increase even more.
We are putting all our energies, how to develop more, how to create more space, but we don't see it as a problem.
Ornella Lipari, editor-in-chief of the business magazine Monitor, is also concerned that it's only a small number of international brands investing in Albania.
This money does not bring the long-term growth because you can build now. You don't have international companies or people who work there.
But back on the beach, visitors are only too aware that Albania wants to become a top tourist destination.
We think that the tourism will take off really soon, big time. It would be nice to go now before it's ruined.
The Albanian government now has the difficult task of encouraging the brands and developers to invest while keeping the landscape that attracts tourists in the first place.
Daniel Rosny. Still to come in this podcast.
On average, as people score higher in their belief in this, there is a kind of higher probability in our studies that they reported being bankrupt.
We take a deeper look at the wellness trend that's become a multi-billion dollar business.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's go to Indonesia now, where Pope Francis is on the first stop of a four-nation tour of Asia, the longest trip of his papacy so far. So why is this trip so interesting? Well, Indonesia has the world's largest Muslim population, but is officially a secular state with significant religious minorities, including around 8 million Roman Catholics. The 87-year-old pontiff has been addressing politicians and religious leaders at the presidential palace in Jakarta.
To favour peaceful and constructive harmony that assures peace and unites forces to defeat the imbalances and bags of misery that still persist in some areas, the Church wants to increase interreligious dialogue. In this way, prejudices can be eliminated and a climate of mutual respect and trust can grow.
Our correspondent Hannah Samosir is covering the Pope's visit in Jakarta.
The Pope has held Indonesia as the model of unity, but he also stressed that there's still extremism in Indonesia. So despite the government efforts to de-radicalize the extremists in Indonesia, there are still a lot of terrorist organizations, even inside the capital city of Jakarta. So to strengthen this message, the Pope wants to hold an interreligious meeting tomorrow at the largest mosque in the Southeast Asia called Istiqlal Mosque. So he wants to strengthen the message by holding this meeting with six other religion leaders.
And Hannah, you talked about extremist groups. That is on the far end of the problems that Indonesia has. But what about on a day-to-day basis? Is there much general intolerance towards religious minorities still?
Yes, the intolerance is not too high, but it's stagnant. There has been a lot, some ban on the for the people who wants to build church and etc. And also they are banning the extremist organizations. Urge the government to close or ban other religion that they want that wants to hold a mass or. But it's just in the outskirts of Indonesia. Not so there are still some incident, but right now the government is trying to address this issue. Some human rights groups said that the effort that done by the government was not enough, and we are still waiting for the next step from the government to address this issue.
And Hannah, I mentioned that there are only 8 million Roman Catholics in Indonesia. What about the rest of the country? Is the Pope's visit getting a lot of credence and a lot of interest from them as well?
Yeah, just this morning I covered the Pope visit to the presidential palace in Jakarta. And when the Pope was holding a meeting with the president outside the presidential palace, people gathered and they hoped to see the sight of the Pope. And they're all coming from the different backgrounds, like they are Muslims, Buddhists, Christians. So Indonesian people welcome the Pope with such a warm welcome, but some of them also said that the Pope also needs to address intolerance that are still happening in Indonesia.
Hannah Somosir there. Now, do you struggle with new technology but are scared to admit it? If so, it seems you're in good company. Two-thirds of business leaders are afraid to admit when they don't understand new technology. That's according to a recent survey. Over half also admitted to spending money on digital services that they don't understand or have not helped the business. Apparently, it's down to a fear of looking old and out of touch. Laura Redman is managing partner at the marketing agency BBD Perfect Storm, which was behind the research, and she spoke to my colleague Sally Bundick.
It is unfortunate that we are seeing that the fear of tech is holding a lot of business leaders back. And I think this has been dazzled by the complexity of the amount of digital solutions and channels available to them. It's becoming quite hard to understand where to invest. And what we're finding is almost half of that, like you said, are losing sleep over the fear of the pace of digital change right now.
And it is extremely fast paced. We've been talking about artificial intelligence so much this year and last year. So what's the answer for those CEOs, bosses of companies who are in this position? What should they do?
I think to eradicate this fear, because it can stifle innovation, it's really important to raise a hand and seek advice, find those experts who can support them and help them navigate through these digital spaces. Because at the minute, we're finding that they're fear admitting that they don't understand. And it is time to take a step back, face into some tough questions and get that advice and help.
It's getting the right advice and help, though, isn't it? Because you get bamboozled by these sort of IT tech consultants who come in with all the language and the jargon that you really don't understand. And you end up paying them a lot of money for services that you still don't understand. And it may not benefit your business.
Well, I think that's fine. That's also true. Like we said, over half of business leaders admitting to having spent money in these places and not understanding the technology. But I think it's important that we come together and not let technology happen to them, but let's make technology work for them, and let's find a way to make it work for their business and make it much more worthwhile in terms of where they're investing and getting the best returns.
That was Laura Redman. Japan has managed to eradicate a population of mongooses after a decades-long battle. They were released on a southern island to kill venomous snakes, but their numbers ended up endangering the umami rabbit, that's a special national treasure. Mickey Bristow reports.
30 mongooses were released on Amami Oshima in the late 1970s to kill a poisonous viper known as the habu. But the snakes are mostly active at night when the mongooses prefer to sleep, so they started attacking rare Amami rabbits instead. The population of rabbits plunged and Japan realised it would have to get rid of the invasive mongooses. The campaign began in the year 2000 using traps and sniffer dogs. The last mongoose was caught 6 years ago, with officials confident they've now all gone.
Now, from mongooses to the business of manifesting. In the modern sense, it means trying to make something happen by imagining it and consciously thinking that it will happen, like a dream job or even a healthy body, a sort of hyper-focused positive thinking. When the pop star Dua Lipa headlined the UK's Glastonbury Festival earlier this year, for example, she said she'd manifested the moment. Some footballers say they envision themselves scoring goals before a game. It's all about seeing yourself doing something and feeling how you'd feel doing it. Well, some people, of course, think that's a bunch of nonsense. Whatever the truth, manifesting is now part of a multi-billion dollar wellness market, particularly online. Business Daily reporter Megan Lawton has been hearing from those who are part of it.
So this is your flat, which you say you manifested.
We're in the Toronto home of Alicia Talian, who has gained 60,000 followers on TikTok in less than a year by posting videos about manifesting.
In the past year, I have significantly changed my entire life, okay? I got a new job.
So there is a lot of money in business. There's a lot of money in manifestation.
It's in this flat that she makes Instagram and TikTok content, which she gets paid for thanks to brand deals and the TikTok Creator Fund, which pays out based on views.
So a few different avenues, of course, is coaching. You can do, if you make TikTok reels, you can make money off of that, or Instagram as well. There's a lot of brand partnerships that you can do.
Alicia's online success is part of a bigger trend which emerged during the pandemic, with searches for the practice rising more than 600% in March 2020, according to Google data. But the business of manifesting goes beyond social media.
Hey, Spiritual Queen, and welcome to my YouTube channel. Here on my
Emma Mumford is the UK's leading manifestation expert, a best-selling author, and host of the Spiritual Queen's Badass podcast. Emma makes her money through her book deals, the wellness retreat she runs, and individual coaching sessions. Since Emma started, she's found manifesting's appeal has broadened.
I think it tends to be younger now as well. When I first started 7-8 years ago, it was more people my own age, kind of in their 30s, 40s, 50s. Whereas now I can see and I can have people in my groups or even come for a one-to-one session and they could be 18 or they could be 60 or 70.
Type manifesting into any search engine and you'll be inundated with podcasts, articles, books, and inspirational quotes. The results that have come up here are all telling me how to manifest anything I want, so instantly you can see the appeal. But not everyone sees the industry so positively.
So on average, as people score higher in their kind of belief in this, there is a kind of higher probability in our studies that they reported being bankrupt.
Dr. Lucas Dixon is from Queensland University, Australia. He's researched the psychology behind the concept of achieving financial success through aspirational thinking.
Manifestors were more likely to believe in get-rich-quick schemes, and they were also more likely to be bankrupt.
Emma Mumford again.
I've never known personally anyone to go bankrupt from manifesting. If anybody online, regardless of a manifestation teacher or you know, anything, self-development, if someone is telling you to do something and it doesn't feel right, like use your discernment with that, trust your intuition with that.
Back in June, Dua Lipa told an audience of over 100,000 people that she manifested her way to headlining Glastonbury's Pyramid Stage. For trend forecasters like Lucy Green, celebrity endorsements such as Dua's give manifesting
tremendous impact on legitimizing it as an idea and a methodology. It kind of sits within a broader trend among millennials and Gen Zs for, and men and women, not just women, for living your best life and using manifesting to self-actualize and achieve everything that you deserve and want.
The Global Wellness Institute estimates that the wellness economy could be worth $8.5 trillion by 2027, with manifesting playing a key part in the growth.
That was Megan Lawton reporting. Almost four decades after the movie Beetlejuice became a smash hit, making around $75 million worldwide, and that was back in 1988, it is back. Director Tim Burton is once again at the helm. Others from the 1988 cast have returned, and they're joined by new stars like Jenna Ortega, perhaps best known for her role as Wednesday. Charlotte Gallagher has met some of the cast.
The juice is loose.
I already was excited because I know when I'm walking into it, just to know if I could bring it. And then you start walking on the sets, and then you go, oh, yeah, I remember this.
Yeah, just see him concentrating here.
Sporting the trademark wild hair and black eyes, Michael Keaton is also joined by Winona Ryder from the original cast.
You're saying that someone called Beetlejuice...
Don't say his name. If you say his name three times, he will appear.
How much of you is in Beetlejuice? I know you're not a demon, but like, do you put some of yourself in it?
How do you know I'm not a demon?
Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice.
Justin Theroux, who is perhaps best known as the former husband of Jennifer Aniston, is one of the new cast members, playing the creepy fiancé.
You're a figment of my imagination.
Really? Is this a figment of your imagination?
Oh. He based the character on his own mother's boyfriends.
My mom was single, or single mom, and periodically, not often, but she would bring back a boyfriend who, you know, she had three kids, and he was trying to ingratiate himself to the family.
Yeah.
And it was way too quick, you know, they'd come in like, hey, what's going on? What are you up to, Dyke? Come on over here, give me a hug. And you're kind of like,
now
all of a sudden
I feel bad for him.
Yeah,
oh, man.
Yeah, totally. But if he wants to, you know, marry this woman, He's got to win the hearts of the family first.
So
what would be the worst thing for him to do right now? It'd be like, yeah, comfort her daughter, you know, like,
yeah, and then propose.
Yeah, exactly.
Wednesday star Jenna Ortega makes her Beetlejuice debut as Winona Ryder's troubled daughter. And Catherine O'Hara returns as her step-grandmother.
This one, it is a lot more emotional than the last one, and I think it's actually pretty incredible to focus, you know, such an insane story, on, you know, which is named after a character who is sleazy and disgusting and gross or whatever, and still make it a film about women and kind of,
and
you know,
love and family.
Exactly.
That's true.
There'd been rumors about a Beetlejuice kind of remake, like Beetlejuice in Hawaii.
Oh, fun.
Were you surprised that at this point, 36 years after, it finally got made?
Yeah, it was funny to actually get a call from the actual director. Tim called and wanted to meet, and he was just in a place where he felt like he'd lost his way, and he just wanted to get back to who he was and what he really loved doing and things he cared about and things that make him laugh, which are all over this movie.
What? Why? No! No! No!
Tania, what's wrong?
Oh, I'm trying to capture the perfect primal scream. I'm going to blow it up, mount it on the wall, and I invite all of you to do the same.
For you, Jenna, I feel like you often play these very strong young women who are not afraid of standing out and being their own person. Is that important to you when you think about you've got so many young fans and then you play these roles that they will stand up for what they believe in?
Yeah, it's incredibly important to me, and especially because, you know, maybe people who feel a little bit weirder, feel like they stick out a little bit more in a crowd, or, you know, it's hard for them to relate to people. I think it's important to see people in these fields, in these worlds, in these environments, and just kind of own it.
Michael Keaton and Tim Burton have made many films together, including two Batmans. But Keaton did have a few reservations about that costume.
The bat suit, you know, which a lot of people laughed at the beginning, the pointy ears and the thing. And, you know, when you're getting into it, you think, oh, boy, this could go poorly. But work that suit, dude. Turn like that, look like that, make that thing powerful.
I'm Batman.
That report by Charlotte Gallagher meeting the cast of Beetlejuice, the sequel. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Sydney Dundon and the producer was Stephanie Prentice. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
That justice system ultimately ignored all of those bodies and all of the families.
The stories they don't want told.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used.
Being lied to, tricked, and traded like a commodity.
Holding the powerful to account.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.